are tuned in to Mid-Morning Empowerment here on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Now, today we're talking about psychosis in teens and in young adults. How does it show up in younger people? When adolescence meets psychosis, the road gets even bumpier. So let's talk about the signs, the struggles, and strength of young people navigating mental health crises at such a critical time. Hanley van der Westhuizen joins us once again from the Vista Clinic. Hanley, good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Bongi.
Thank you for joining us once again. Let's get into it. Why is psychosis often first diagnosed in the late teens or early 20s? Is that a coincidence?
Bongi, yes, there is a definite reason why. And I think the main reason why this happens is to be seek in the developmental milestones that a teenager has. Okay. So first, we need to understand a little bit what is happening in the teenage brain before we can go on to that question. During the teenage years, there's significant neurobiological and brain development milestones that shape cognitive, emotional, and behavioral functioning. And these changes are part of an ongoing maturation process of the brain, particularly in regions involved decision-making, impulse control, and social cognition. Just to quickly name them, these key milestones include the prefrontal cortex development, the limbic system maturation, synaptic pruning and myelination, and then changes in the dopamine pathway system. And then also lastly, enhancing connectivity and integration of the brain. To understand what is happening, the ongoing pruning and myelination is, you know, the brain shaves away the weaker or unused neural connections to improve efficiency. Okay. And this process is uneven and can temporarily disrupt cognitive and emotional functioning. Mm. It's a gradual process, and it can lead to periods of increased vulnerability to mental issues in the teenager. There's also, you know, the prefrontal cortex is responsible for executive functions like decision making, impulse control, and planning. And it matures later than the limbic system, which regulates emotions and reward processing. And this imbalance can lead to heightened emotional reactivity and risk-taking behaviors that we so often see with teenagers, because it is due to the fact that the emotional centers develop faster than the regulatory control systems. Mm. And then, you know, the adolescence is a critical period for developing social cognition and emotional regulation. And challenges in these areas are common as the brain fine-tuned circuits evolve in understanding others and managing situations. So there's a definite development of the neural circuits for social and emotional processing. The adolescent brain is highly plastic and receptive to environmental influences.
Okay.
While this plasticity allows for learning and adaption, it also means that negative experiences such as stress, trauma, even substance use can have a more profound impact and potentially disrupting normal development. And then there's also the hormonal changes. Puberty involves significant hormonal shifts that influence brain development, yes, mood, and behavior. And these hormonal fluctuations can contribute to mood swings, increased emotional sensitivity, and vulnerability to mental health conditions. There's just an ongoing reorganization in the brain that makes it more susceptible to disruptions, which can manifest as mental health challenges, including mood disorder, anxiety, or psychosis, especially if there are genetic predispositions or then adverse environmental factors. There's also the thorny issue of substances. You know, adolescence is a time when many teens experiment with substances like cigarettes, alcohol,
right,
and marijuana.
Yeah.
And these substances can significantly impact brain development during this critical period in several ways. You know, it interferes with brain maturation. There's definite disruption of the neurodevelopment processes. Substances like alcohol and weed can interfere with ongoing processes such as the synaptic pruning and the myelination. And this interference can alter the normal maturation of the brain circuits involved in decision-making, impulse control, and emotional regulation. Chronic use during adolescence can lead to lasting changes in brain structure, particularly in the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system. And I just want to add to this with a more practical example, because in practice, when working with people who have started substance use early in their life and had a chronic problem with substance use, I can often see that their emotional development and their developmental maturation has been kept stagnant. And I will almost have, you know, a 36-year-old sitting in front of me, and they've got the emotional processing and interactional patterns and decision-making patterns of a 13-year-old or 16-year-old. And when we ask, when did you start the substance use very prevalently in your life, it almost always concur with that time when they started. And this is just a practical a reflection on what the books say and what the academic and theory and research says. It is actually true, and we see it in practice. It also impacts on the neurotransmitter systems. It causes altered brain chemistry. The substances affect the neurotransmitter systems like the dopamine, serotonin, and the glutamate, which are crucial for mood regulation, reward processing, and cognition. And these can really potentially lead to increased risk-taking and dependence. So this is a very, very sensitive time period in the individual's life. I have mentioned in our previous talks that the psychosis risk is much higher for the use of marijuana, like we call it dacha or weed, especially in the high-potency strains, because those have been linked to increased risk of developing psychosis, and then particularly in individuals with genetic vulnerability or pre-existing mental health issue. I often say to teens, yes, there are some of your friends who get away with using drugs and nothing ever happens to them, but you will never know. You will never know what risk factors you have and how it's going to turn out for you. So there's really an exacerbation of existing vulnerabilities with substance use, and it can really accelerate or worsen underlying mental health conditions. I think also, there's impairment of cognitive and emotional functions. Alcohol, marijuana can impair memory, attention, and learning, which are all still developing during adolescence. And these are actually crucial things needed to complete certain developmental milestones of the teen. I mean, the teen needs to complete at least schooling in their teen years. It's a very important job, if I can say it, of a teenager is to complete schooling and this can really influence this, and it also leads to emotional dysregulation. Mm-hmm. And then obviously there's the behavioral and social consequences. The substances can really increase risky behaviors, social withdrawal, and usually engaging in environments that further expose the adolescent to stresses or negative influences and compounding the issue. When we talk about teens and why they get identified earlier, we need to talk a little bit about the whole issue of early onset psychosis, and what we need to know about this is that there's key features of early onset psychosis. It is typically diagnosed in children, preteens, or teenagers. Mm-hmm. Although the exact age cutoff varies, early onset usually refers to symptoms beginning before 18 years of age. When psychosis develops before the age of 13, it is often called very early onset or childhood onset psychosis, which is rarer, but it tends to have a different prognosis and overall different picture. Mm-hmm. So key features of early onset psychosis is most commonly auditory hallucination, like hearing voices or sometimes visual, delusions, fixed false beliefs, disorganized speech and thinking, abnormal motor behavior or catatonia, and very strong social withdrawal or decline in functioning. So it's a little bit different from adult onset psychosis in that it's often more severe and persistent. It is frequently associated with other neurodevelopment disorders, and it really has a different course or response to treatment. So it's something that's rare, but it's important that we have early detection and treatment because these are crucial. Yeah. And it's a high risk of chronic mental health issue when the onset is as early as 13 or underneath the cutoff of 18 years. Mm-hmm. So that is a little bit different, but if it is associated with substance use, then as we explained earlier, the course and the treatment are different and very often far more optimistic than the other forms.
Right. And would you say those are some of the early signs that parents and teachers can be looking out for?
Yeah, definitely. I think what is important is that parents and teachers look out for those very positive symptoms like the hallucinations, the disorganized thinking. Very often there's the delusional component that indicates that the person is a little bit paranoid or not trusting. So those are very important. And also, if you see that people are less, to an extent, less social, when they're starting to experience academic problems, because the psychosis influence with the effectiveness of the brain, people struggle to concentrate, to focus, to have attention when they struggle with psychosis. And then also where the teenager or are set isolation, but also, they're sleeping more. There are periods where they really struggle to activate themselves, loss of interest in things that they usually liked. And then, personal hygiene usually take a serious lap as well. Mm-hmm. So those are all things, that one can look at, and that will help. I think what is important is stay observant, notice whether this is persistent changes over weeks or months. Maintain open communication, encourage the teens to share their feelings and experiences without judgment. And if there's multiple signs and if the symptoms are there over a duration of time and the symptoms are getting more severe, consult a mental health professional promptly. Try to reduce stress, educate yourself about these things and try to provide a supportive environment.
Yeah. And how does a psychosis then affect a young person's school life and social life and things like that?
Well, it is very important. It significantly influences a teen's experience at school, affecting their academic performance, social interactions, and overall school life. And you can imagine how much stress this places on the teen, because as I say, the job of a teenager is to complete, their schooling career. So it places a lot of stress on them if they find it difficult to perform. First and foremost are the academic difficulties, these difficulties with concentration. The hallucinations or intrusive thoughts can make it very, very hard to focus on lessons. There's memory issues. They struggle to retain information. and there's a definite decline in performance that you can witness. You know, there's reduced participation in class, there's missed assignments. You can see the dropping of grades due to the cognitive disruptions. Another thing that is often seen is abstinism. You know, frequent absences stemming from distress, hospital visits, or fatigue related to the symptoms. Or then if the person is in treatment, medication side effects also have influence. There's also the social challenges at school. They avoid peer interactions due to the paranoia, fear, or embarrassment. And there's often misunderstandings. You know, the peers and the teachers may misinterpret unusual behavior or speech as misconduct or lack of interest, which leads to feelings of being misunderstood and can lead to loneliness and difficulty forming friendships. Mm-hmm. There can also be behavioral issues. You know, there can be disorganized or bizarre behavior. This may include talking to oneself or unusual movements or inappropriate reactions, which can disrupt a class. Sometimes there can be impulsivity or aggression, increased irritability or agitation that can lead to conflicts with teachers or classmates. Mm-hmm. And very often the disrupted thinking may impair the understanding and can cause difficulty to adhere to the school rules. There's also the emotional and psychological impact. Very often there's anxiety and stress.
Okay.
And there's low self-esteem very often because there's feelings of shame and shame about the experience that can undermine their confidence. And then big, big, big thing is the fear of stigma. There's a lot of concern about being labeled or judged, and that may prevent teens from seeking help or even participating fully at school activities. Mm-hmm. So you know, reduced motivation is another issue. You know, their difficulty in performing tasks and, you know, they struggle to communicate their needs. And it's very often difficult for teen. In some of the past sessions, I've mentioned the issue of advocacy. You know, they've got a right to ask for longer time periods to complete tasks, or, you know, ask for assistance during exams and things like that. It's very, very difficult for a teen to communicate their needs and to you know, have self-advocacy. It's difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what treatment approaches work best for this age group?
Yeah, this is interesting. I think what is important is that we should also keep, the idea that a teen has certain developmental milestones that they need to complete in mind when we also think of what support we should give. So the ordinary mental health route, like going to a psychiatrist, get medication, see a clinical psychologist to get, you know, in-depth help with the positive symptoms, you know, the multidisciplinary approach to have counselors, occupational therapists, psych educators on board, that is definitely very, very useful. But we need to also try to support them in our treatment with ways that really work for them, you know, and very often, you know, the family therapy approach helps a lot because it helps them to communicate with the most important support system. That is very, very important. But something that I really find work very effective with teens, but should be used alongside individual therapy and other interventions, is the whole issue of group therapy. Mm-hmm. And the reason why this work is because there's peer support and validation in this. Teens often feel understood and less isolated when they see others are facing similar struggles. Those sharing experience can reduce feelings of shame and promote a sense of belonging. It also helps them to develop their social skills because they've got a safe space where they can practice communication, assertiveness, conflict resolution. And it helps to improve their interpersonal relationships outside of the therapy. What I also like about it, it's cost effective. It's usually less expensive than individual therapy, making the mental health support more accessible, and it facilitates different perspectives because it, you know, you have diverse viewpoints within a group therapy session. So and very often the group keeps the individual responsible and accountable. So we've got quite a common few group therapy types for teens, and it's the support groups and it's the skill building groups. Then there's the CBT groups that use CBT techniques to address particular problems collectively. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the family or parent-teen groups that involve family members to improve communication. Mm-hmm. What I like about this, it's sustainable, but it is also important to know that it's very, there are considerations. It's not suitable for every person. Mm-hmm. Not everybody will like this approach. And so we need to have a very individual focused treatment plan. The other thing that I also like when working with teens is, you know, I think younger therapists are almost like role models and can be really beneficial in some contexts for teens, especially when it comes to building trust, relatability, and motivation. Right. So I usually like that because it also reduced the power distance. You know, and it's easier to build trust. But, you know, what is important with this is psychosis is a very, very tricky problem. And there are considerations and limitations when, you know, using young therapists, because very often the experience and competence is a little bit lacking. Mm-hmm. But we can, overrule that with the help of mentorship and having, you know, young therapists, working in a well-established multidisciplinary team where there are older therapists taking mentorship and supervision roles. And then something else that is important, the teenager are usually busy with their telephone. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of support services on the phone. And what I want to just highlight here is Text a Tip. Text a Tip is the name of this organization or support initiative. It is a South African-based confidential helpline service designed to promote and provide support, advice, and intervention for individuals, especially mm-hmm. young people, facing various challenges, including mental health issues. It leverages SMS messaging to reach users discreetly and conveniently. Mm-hmm. So it is really safe, it's confidential, it's an accessible platform for people to seek help, report issues, to get advice relating to mental health. The target audience is primarily aimed at youth, but any person or anyone in need can make use of the support. Mm-hmm. And the mode is the SMS text-based messaging, making it accessible even without internet access, which is important in areas with limited connectivity. So the fact that is most important for me with this is that it's anonymous and confidential. There's immediate support. There's crisis intervention help that can facilitate urgent help, including connecting users to emergency services or mental health professionals. And they give a lot of information and referral information regarding available resources, support groups, and helplines. So it's a nice thing. And then the other one is the whole issue of apps. And here I've tried to just get, just to name a few apps that I've seen is free. And they are usually, I've looked at ones that are particularly most reputable and popular mental health apps suited for teenagers. Because it's very important to know that they are reputable, that they're doing what they do, that they've got a professional mental health backing, mm-hmm. and that they use evidence-based approaches and a user-friendly interface tailored at teens or young people. So just to name a few is Mood Tools. They are also free. They got mood journals, guided meditation, thought records, and information on depression. Headspace is about mindfulness and meditation, which is really good to help, managing anxiety, sleep-related issues, and to help reduce stress, stress reduction techniques. And they've got a free trial. And then there's Calm. They've got limited features that are free. Mm-hmm. And it's also stress reduction, sleep and relaxation using the mindfulness approach. Yupa is all about emotional health and mood tracking. And they've also got an AI-powered chat for emotional support, which is very nice. And it's also free. Worry Tree is anxiety management. Sunvelo is now the new name for Pacifica. Which is also free, and they've got comprehensive support for teens and managing mood disorders. And then MindDoc is also free. Breathe to Relax, Safe Place. There are very, very, there's so much apps available right now. I just want to say to listeners, tips for choosing the right app. First look at age appropriateness, ensure that the app is essentially suitable for teens. Make sure that there's privacy and data security. Check how the app handles personal information. Okay. Make sure that it's evidence-based. I prefer apps grounded in psychological research. Look for apps that are engagement-focused. They engage and they are youth-friendly design. And then also complementary use. It's important to know that apps are tools and they are not replacements for professionals. Right. So, they help, but they can't do the whole thing.
Yes, very important. Thank you so much, Hanley. As we are wrapping up, any final thoughts you'd like to share on the subject?
I think what is important is that there are a lot of resources available in South Africa that mm-hmm. provide private, confidential, and accessible mental health support. Childline is an important figure to mention here. SADOC, yeah. Lifeline South Africa. They use WhatsApp and online support platforms. So, there are a lot of initiatives. There's a lot of school and community-based programs, NGOs. Reach out, make sure that you're connected in your community, because your community will most is extremely important. Any judgment, ask more, listen more, say less.
Very important. Thank you so much, Hanley, for coming through once again. Very important tips that you've shared there, and I trust that they have they've landed where they should. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Take care, Borongi. Bye-bye.
All right.
You are tuned in to Mid-Morning Empowerment here on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.